Hello and welcome to the Project Scars podcast. Great to have all of you back this lovely Wednesday afternoon. My name is Seth Mears.
Every time.
Yeah, not good at pushing that button two times. I can push it once, no problem. Pushing it twice, it's a real issue for me.
But Stinger's going to get you.
joining me on the show. I'm going to learn how to play the bass so that I can imitate that bass line. That's what
just
I want
to
do.
Just take it for a walk, buddy.
We should. It would be a real twist because that song was created entirely in a digital environment and no real instruments were harmed in the making of it whatsoever. So, yeah.
Until now.
Brett Evans, Kyle Hyatt, I'm Seth Miersma. Together we are the Project Scars podcast. It's going to be fast and loose today. I'm not going to lie. Like we've got a lot to talk about. We've got a lot of cars on our brains, but we also are all busy and tired. Kyle, you were just telling me you're tired because despite the fact that you live a life of leisure with a beautiful cat and no children, you were unable to sleep last night.
The cat's part of the problem, more so that there's three of them. Yeah. And even with a king size bed, like my wife is 6'2", I'm 6'4", and our cats are the size of human toddlers. Like it's a bad scene. And I don't know what real sleep is anymore. Also, as I creep towards 40, sleep just gets worse, you know, yeah, like really, really staring down the barrel of that, that 40th year. And it's not working for me.
That is real. I can attest to it. I've never been a good sleeper and it has only gotten worse as I've gotten older. So,
and there in the background was one of my, giant toddler sized cats. God's perfect cat. Idiot. Jonesy.
Is that Jonesy? Jonesy is the only other one that we've seen, or at least that you've ID'd on the podcast so far.
Yeah, I don't think we've seen Murray or Wally, but I'm sure eventually they'll meander in, you know, at some point.
What about you, Brett? I see that you've also got some caffeine, but you're looking sharp today. We've got a haircut, Brett, and we appreciate that. For those of you watching, if you're listening, you're just going to have to imagine a Brett Evans and then take 15% of his hair away.
Yeah. I lost probably 5 pounds yesterday. It was great. I'm similarly, I don't have an excuse because my boyfriend's out of town, and when the cat's away, the mice will play, which meant I went to IKEA last night by myself.
Wild.
All right, brother.
Got home and went to bed at 10:30 and also slept like absolute garbage. So caffeine is doing the Lord's work today.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to, I don't know, maybe just focus on sleep. I think all three of us should really like focus in on sleep for the rest of the week and see.
We'll download some apps. There'll be some sleep hygiene.
I got home and I was like, you know what? I'm not even going to turn on the TV. I'm going to go straight to bed. I'm going to bring my dog up with me and we're going to have a great night. And it didn't work out. I ended up rolling over on her in the middle of the night and she yelped. It was not a good night.
Yeah. I hate that for you. I'm really sorry.
What's your coffee mug, Brett? Is that a Lotta mug? Oh, even better. We love them.
Honda with a sideways heart.
It's like a weird, they didn't even use, I don't even think it's a real logo type that they use, but they sell it in the gift shop at the Honda Museum. So I bought it.
Yeah, it looks a little bit like a Timu Honda logo.
Yeah, it really does.
But I like it anyways. Like I applaud the designer. So
what's Honda logo your mom says we have at home.
Yeah. What's your excuse, Seth? Why are you sleeping today?
I also went to bed at a reasonable hour for me, but I was out. We were DMing about this yesterday. My great friend Priyanka Matu, who is a newly minted author, she just wrote a wonderful book that I encourage everybody out there to check out. It's called Bird Milk and Mosquito Bones. It's got literally nothing to do with cars whatsoever, but it's a fantastic memoir that I loved reading. She was in town last night in Ann Arbor to do a book reading and a little bit of an event, and then we went out to dinner afterwards and had a really nice time. I had 3 gin and tonics, and as I was telling Kyle, I am unaccustomed to drinking strong alcohol during the week now. I've really turned my life around. Used to be, I could have 6 gin and tonics and it wouldn't even faze me. And now I got a crappy night's sleep. So just a little grumpy, a little slow to react. And
I know as we were putting this together, all of us were a little snipey for some reason. Yeah. We're having a hard time. Time with each other today.
Yeah. I don't want to do it. You do it. That's
hopefully this breeds the kind of drama that makes people tune in instead of the kind of drama that makes people like navigate away.
Yeah. I mean, I can see our view count wandering up and down sort of precipitously. So maybe we should get into the heart of the car topic. I promise you guys, we're going to put a picture of a car on the screen relatively soon if you're watching this. Also, if you're watching this, please, by all means, when we start talking cars, we've got some good stuff today. We're going to talk about a Porsche. We're going to talk about some BMWs. We're going to talk about some really weird cars that we would like to own if we didn't have to worry about them breaking down and leaving us stranded. It's going to be great. I promise. If you have questions or comments about any of it, throw it on the screen. Write a comment wherever you're watching this, on YouTube, on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter. We'll throw it on the screen and we'll have ourselves a conversation. Before we do that, let me just remind you that Project Scars is presented to you by CarID.com. Fix it, upgrade it, customize it. CarID.com is your car parts destination. And it's also brought to you by the CarID Drive blog that we all love and attend to like it is our child. Check it out. You can find amazing stories about cars, owners, incredible builds, unbelievable driving adventures, and get inspired for your next automotive project. With that out of the way, what was everybody driving this week? Kyle, why don't you start? We talked a little, I think we talked about a bit about it this week, but you're having some sad feelings.
Yeah, a little bit of, calling it postpartum depression would be a little strong. The Panamera I was driving last week went away yesterday, and I'm feeling pretty sad about it. You know, it was a really, really, really good car. I took it up in the famous Angeles Crest Highway, Angeles Forest, to shoot some photos. One of which is this photo here. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really, you know, I mostly just been driving it around town and stuff. And this thing is like not fast at all. I mean, it's like 348 horsepower and 900,000 pounds. But it was so much fun. Like, there's so much grip and like that long wheelbase, it feels so stable. And I was really like pushing it hard up there and it was great. And then when I had to watch the fleet company gentleman take it away, I was, you know, a lone tear didn't roll down my cheek, but I was thinking about it.
This is the part of the job that no one will ever pity us for, even slightly. But I remember when I think it was maybe the GR Corolla. I remember the GR Corolla, I was driving it for a week and then they came and picked it up and I posted like a video on Instagram, like a story on Instagram of the dude like driving it away and had like a little like sad face emoji or whatever. And my friend was like, oh, poor you. You had to give away your free GR Corolla that you got to drive for a week and not have to pay for the gas and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, but you don't get it. Like, I was happier before I knew how great the GR Corolla was. And now it's not in my life and I'm sad. You don't get it.
The GR Corolla is wonderful. The Panamera seems wonderful. I mean, Kyle, I think that maybe the saddest thing of all is you're back down to being just a one Porsche man now instead of a two Porsche man like you were for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Please send thoughts and prayers to my little family during this difficult time.
If anybody has a special message for Kyle, you can hit us up at tips@carid.com and talk about the loneliness of being just a one Porsche guy. No, but no, for sure. When fun cars go away, it's always sad. We are incredibly lucky, right, Brett? We have to say this over and over again, right? Automotive journalists have a really great gig. There are parts about it that are difficult and that we struggle with and that make it an unsustainable career in many cases for lots of people. But the cars are amazing and having access to them is great. So. But we also really love cars, so we're sad when the good ones go away as much as we like to share the next one.
It's not something that happens like every time. Like more often than not, I'm usually like, a week's enough, you know, that's good.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad I had this experience, you know, bon chance, and like, where's the next one? But this one I was actually kind of bummed because it's like, it's the perfect LA car, this Panamera. It's gray. It's the base model. Nobody's paying attention to it. Mm-hmm. It's super comfortable. It's got the... Even the base model has air suspension, which you obviously love, Seth. I know. You have really positive experiences with that. And it's just like, it's quiet. The interior is phenomenal. Like it's just good. It just does everything well. And like the other part, it's gray, so it's invisible. Like that's a thing that there's like, I think two sort of tribes of people in LA when it comes to cars, like the people that want to be seen and the people that just prefer to be completely invisible. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely one of the latter, like driving around in like a lime green Lamborghini is awesome for about 20 minutes. And then it, like, every time you stop, it becomes a hassle, or like people are like, I'm not going to let you in on the freeway. Right. But driving around in like a gray Porsche, nobody cares. Like, you can, you know, it's like, whatever, you know.
I think that the, like, one thing that I appreciate about this car though is, and, you know, like, cars get newer, the styling is fresh to our eyes, so we like the way it looks. Obviously, like, almost every car gets a slightly more aggressive or bigger, like, wheel tire package as time goes by too. But all that being said, I do find the current iteration of, again, this is like kind of close to a base version of the Panamera, a lot more attractive than when the Panamera first debuted. I thought that it looked okay in the higher, in like, you know, turbo and higher trim levels, but the base trim level, although it was a fine car to drive, was sort of dorky looking. It was under-wheeled in my mind, a little too round and bubbly. So I think they've taken that away, and it looks more like a proper Porsche, even in the base spec here. As well, should we talked about it last week? It's $100,000, right? Or more than $100,000.
Yeah, so this one's like $120,000, and it is the base model. I mean, it's not all-wheel drive, it's not anything, and it has like a handful of options, not a ton. And yeah, it's still $120,000. But I, you know what? As much as any car can be worth $120,000, I'd say that this one doesn't leave a lot to be desired. So,
love it. Well, I'm going to talk about two cars, one that is gone and one that is still in my driveway this week. So the car that I had for the better part of last week, if I can pull this up, is the BMW X2, and specifically the version of it, the M35i version of it. So not a true M car. Let me see if I can zoom in. But when the M is in front, it's always like M tuned. So we've got some, you know, more power than the standard X5. I think this is a 2-liter turbo making 312 horsepower. And I'll click through a little bit. We've got some like a definitely M vibe on the interior, those big wheels, that weird little ducktail spoiler on the edge of it. I can't quite get my head around whether or not I like the looks of this car or I find it very weird in this trim. I actually think that going back to base models, like the base model of this car is a little bit more attractive to me because it looks a little less chunky. These wheels are really big and, you know, great tires and all that. But it just seems sort of strange. The interior though, you know, you can take or leave it. If you're a red interior person, you might absolutely hate this actual colorway. But the seats are really great. I've got one of the trunk there. Awesome steering wheel, like lots of leather. I think really well done for the front two seats. It's a super comfortable car for, I think, all shapes and sizes of people. There's lots of adjustability there. As a tall person, like, I had no issue. And kind of surprisingly roomy in the back seat as well. Ignore the fact that floor mat is really dirty. I apologize. These were last minute photos. But
does that have a mechanical rear axle, or is it like an electric? That seems like a really open wide center console for an all wheel drive car.
That's a great question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I haven't begun to do the sort of reporting on review of this yet, so I'm not sure. And it was a shorter loan too, to just be totally frank with you guys. So I was really in this car for like 4 days, but you're right. It is wide open, tons of storage space. And a little bit of a, like a strange one too, I guess. And I wanted to talk about quickly the other car, one car that's in my driveway right now. And let me pull up that, because I think that there's a little bit of a theme here. And that is the, let's see, the Lexus 500H Coupe, right? So a couple of weeks ago, I had a, LC, I forgot to say the LC part, very critical. I had an LC 500 convertible, 500 non-hybrid, right? This is the 500 hybrid and the coupe version. Both cars look incredible, look amazing. Like, honestly, like some of the coolest looking big coupes on the road today. I think some of my favorite interior design and interior styling touch points, awesome door handles and like door cards are suede everywhere. They're really neat. But the hybrid version is not super exciting to drive, to say the least. It's 350-ish horsepower. Not to have the spec at hand, but it's something, it's, you know, 350, 360 horsepower, something like that, under 400 horsepower, whereas the LC500 with the V8 is 500 horsepower, and you feel every bit of it. right? These are weird. So the line that I'm trying to draw between these two is I really like the X2. I like the base X2, the 28i, quite a lot. I like the packaging. I think the powertrain is appropriate. I love the high-end version. Although I say high-end, the hybrid is more expensive than the V8 version, which I was shocked to be reminded of when I looked them up. Not by a lot, but it is. But can you guys think of this? Like, are there other existing examples of like variants, powertrains, whatevers, of vehicles that you love in one format and kind of don't get or don't like in other formats?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a bunch of that kind of thing. It depends. Like, so the like Toyota is a great example of talking about hybrids. Mm-hmm. The hybrid Corolla, I think, is phenomenal. Like, that's great an incredible car. Like, I think I described it once as being like our generation's people's car. You know, like the Volkswagen Beetle or the Citroen mm-hmm. Deschevo, where it's like cheap. It's meant to be run into the ground. It's utilitarian, that kind of thing. Great. All the other Corolla trims are lame. Like, they shouldn't exist. They're dumb. the Apex is fun for like a minute. I once got somebody in a Lotus Elise to pull over on Angeles Crest because I was like on them so hard. I think it was more that they were a bad driver than I was actually fast, but it felt really good mm-hmm. personally. But yeah, I think that's a good example. It's just, yeah, like it's the drivetrain in cars now is oftentimes like not front and center in the way that it used to be. So, you know, sometimes it's ignorable, but in cars like this where, you know, like the Lexus is a great example where it's like, it's a statement, yeah. You know, like it's a little bit of theater.
Mm-hmm.
The drivetrain is really important. And so, yeah, like, yeah.
I've tried to mentally justify the hybrid so many times in the LC so many times because like it's a stunner. It looks so good. And the idea of really good fuel economy, like in such a comfortable long distance grand touring vehicle makes a lot of sense to me. And then I drove I've never driven the hybrid, but I drove the V8 a few years ago. And that engine is just like, it makes the whole experience, like the styling and the interior and everything like that. That's all fabulous, but it's the roar and like the power of that 5-liter naturally aspirated Lexus V8 that just makes it. It's so good. So I agree. This would be a hard one for me.
And I'm not like a snob when it comes to, we were just talking about base models, like base model Panamera. I'm certainly not a snob when it comes to base models. And I'm also not like somebody who can say it's not a Mustang or a Camaro unless it's got a V8 in it. Right. Like I like lots of sports cars that have different powertrains that are kind of down the ladder in terms of output. Oftentimes the trade-off is sort of better handling. You've got a lighter nose or something like that in the case of those pony cars. I also like, you know, engines, smaller engines that really like that you've got to rev out or that are turbocharged so that they're more exciting that way. You know, I think that it's not that I need for it to be a V8. I just think that this is a strange one because one, I'm paying less to have the engine that I vastly prefer to drive. This isn't a car that is, I would guess that most people who own a Lexus LC of any kind don't daily it, right? It's not, you know, it's a second car. It's a fun car or something like that. And it's, so the argument about it being less efficient is for the V8 is offset by the fact that one, it's cheaper and two, it's better to drive, right? So I don't know how much longer you would need to drive your LC500 hybrid on weekends or, you know, like every once in a while over the course of the week for that to make like dollars and cents. I guess that most people just don't care that much. They like the way that it looks a lot. And maybe they have a Toyota hybrid as their primary vehicle. And so it feels like something that, is part of their, you know, personal brand as a driver or something like that. But
I wonder if Lexus breaks out sales figures by, powertrain. I think they might. I'm going to look it up real quick. I want to know how many hybrids are selling versus V8.
Yeah, it'd be something worth asking if it's not publicly available. A lot of times automakers don't, but I'd be really curious about it. Mm-hmm. And again, this isn't me trying to, the other one, the X2, the M35i version of it is kind of the opposite version of this same argument, right? Like it's a vehicle type that to me is really enjoyable and sort of well done with lower power, smaller wheels. I don't really need all that grip because even when it's got 300 horsepower, it's not very rewarding for me to drive super fast if I've got my five-year-old in a car seat in the back, which is kind of the idea of having a compact crossover small SUV like that, is that it's a car that you can use pretty well in the city, but also use for some family life. It's got good storage and things like that. So why do I need to spend, in my case, I think it was optioned up to $60,000 or something like that. Even for a BMW, like, why do I need to spend that much money to have, I don't see the advantage, I guess. So,
and plus it looks like a Ford Mustang Mach-E that somebody drew from memory after like four beers. Like, it's not an attractive car. I'm anti-coupe over in general, but I think like the first generation X2 was actually pretty handsome.
Yeah,
with the roundels on the C pillar and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then with the LC, I'm gonna have to put on my flame suit here from the internet. But I'm like the only person that does not like that V8. I don't get why people love it. Huh. Because at lower revs, it runs on the Atkinson cycle, like a Prius engine, right? So they do it for efficiency, but that also means that there is nobody home below like $4,000 or $5,000. And like when you're driving it around, like in town, which is where I think you're driving a car most of the time, mm-hmm. it's just, you're just like puttering along and you're like, you're not getting to take advantage of it. I mean, once you're like all the way up it, yeah, it sounds great and it's responsive and stuff, but like, it's just not where that car is, I think, getting used most of the time. And
let me break in here real quick. Car ID will now be hiring a new contributing editor. If you'd like to send your resumes to tips@carid.com, we'd love to hear from you. No, you're right. Fire. There's no torque in that thing. It's absolute, like, it is a very peaky revvy engine, but that's why I love it. Oh my god.
You can shift around if you really want to get aggressive. And I'd say, I don't think that you're wrong, Kyle. I would say, I mean, I don't think that you're wrong about the way that it lays power down. I would say that the advantage of it is, again, going back to the idea of the hybrid, that a Lexus sports car buyer is probably more likely to want to have that sort of dual personality where they can drive without thinking about it most of the time and then get hard on the throttle 5% of the time or use the paddle shifters 5% of the time when they want to take advantage of all the power that's there, right?
Right,
It's a different idea in my head than an M car or an AMG or a proper muscle car or something like that, right?
Well, my heart is two sizes too small. So, I mean, it's also like, it doesn't sound great at low RPM, again, because of the thing, which if you're going to have like a big, naturally aspirated, high revving V8, which is a wonderful thing, we mm-hmm. can all agree, I think, aside from the environmental standpoint, right. But, like make it worth it. Like what's the point, you know? Like you're going through all the effort to put it in there and do it, and like I'm not even saying
because there's so many naturally aspirated high revving V8s that don't make torque down low, like the S65, I think the BMW V8
but it sounds cool throughout its whole rev range.
So does the 5 liter, so does the Lexus 5 liter.
I'm gonna agree to disagree.
Like if you're gonna, you know, yeah,
we'll have to arm wrestle about it later.
All right.
I think it sounds great at idle. I don't remember the sound a lot, like when I'm
exactly.
just at you know 1500 RPMs, because I don't think it's super loud. I don't think that there's you know, maybe this is an exhaust problem. You're mentioning like the Atkins cycle, which could be correct too. Maybe there's I don't know, it's worth looking into. You know, as it turns out, carparts.com might be a great place to go look for a little bit of an exhaust upgrade if you want a throatier version of your Lexus.
I would agree.
500.
Yeah.
It'd be really interesting to see. That's not a car that I think a lot of people modify. And actually, I think that weirdly, it would be awesome to have somebody do a really crazy build of an LC of any kind.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that happening in a few years. Like once they start to be slightly more accessible. I think that'll be awesome because I think they are gorgeous. Like they're super cool. And I think the convertible in particular looks great. Like I like it better than the coupe, which is a rare thing for me.
I agree that they both look good. I apologize, by the way, for not having a photo of the one that's in my driveway. It got rained on immediately, so it's super dirty, but it's the same color that I had before, which is copper, dusky copper,
copper
something.
Crest. Ooh, copper crest. Nice.
it's nice. Silver black wheels, like big black wheels, and it actually looks really, really mean, which is another reason I'm slightly disappointed at the hybrid powertrain, because it absolutely is not mean.
Real quick, I want to break in and say, in 2023, of the 1,761 Lexus LCs that were sold, how many do you think were hybrids? 1,761.
13.
I'm going to say, I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to say that it was 1,000 plus.
Kyle is the closest without going over, and the closest period, because it was 37.
Oh, 37. My God. Wow.
No one is buying these in hybrid, apparently.
I wonder. Maybe it's like a cafe thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just literally like Toyota being like, hey, we tried.
For our viewers, that's corporate average fuel economy, which is the bane of companies like Ferrari and, you know, whatever. That's why, like, that's why Ferrari sells bicycles, you know, branded bicycles, obviously.
Real quick, I just want to say thanks to Javon Williamson for throwing a comment up there. He's asking whether or not we spoke about the LFA already. We've been talking Lexus. We've been talking about the Lexus LC500 hybrid, which is not as cool as an LFA. I think that the LFA styling,
it's sort of a spiritual successor, I think.
Yeah, like that was such an important car for Lexus sports cars, especially. That you can still see some elements of that design in cars like the LC have been out for a while, but are on sale right now. Did either of you guys, I never had the pleasure of driving LFA. There was never one. I live in Michigan. They never brought one to our market as a test car. And they offered me once years ago when it was new that I could drive one in Los Angeles, but I had to have a racing license and I could only drive it on a track. So I didn't have those at the time, and I wasn't able to fly in LA and like rent a track to drive a car, unfortunately.
I wonder if they have one like in the museum, because I know they shipped all like most of their museum stuff over to Plano, but like, and I don't remember if they're like as good about letting stuff out of the museum as like Honda is, but
they're not. Definitely keep that stuff under lock and key a little bit more, but that would be an interesting conversation to have.
Yeah, shout out to Carl Pulley, who runs the Honda Museum now, for letting those sweet babies off the chain. Like, he's the reason I got to drive a Integra Type R, which changed me utterly. I'm a different man now.
That's my torches and pitchforks opinion, is that the Type R is fine. So
that the Type R, I thought you loved the Type R.
I don't know. Maybe I didn't get on it hard enough. I remember it being like, fine, just great.
The Integra Type R is spectacular while you're in VTEC, and it just wants to live at Redline. And the steering is beautiful. The gearbox is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. The shift knob is stupid because it's... The shifter's great. The shift knob is idiotic because it turns into a branding iron anytime you let it sit in the sun.
Oh, sure. Come on.
That's a problem. It's a real problem here in Los Angeles. I'm gonna end up looking
branding
like
branding iron.
Basically,
yeah, it's like an aluminum milled piece, and it has like the H pattern embossed in it. It fully is. It's brutal for sure.
I'm gonna end up looking like the guy from the Indiana Jones movie
where they grab the.
That's gonna be me. Actually, in my X5, like the previous owner put an aluminum shift knob in there, and every time I'm like, I need to order that ZHP knob, and I keep thinking like, I'll do it later, I'll get it later, and then I burn myself, and it's terrible.
For those of we're off on like we're two tangents or three tangents deep at this point, but for Javon and for those of you who are listening and not watching, I just found a random Motor Trend picture of a kind of lava orange LFA that's reigniting my sadness about not driving this car before. Maybe we'll make it happen. There are lots of people out there with awesome car collections. It's not like this was the most limited supercar in the world. I think it's really special, and it would be fun to go out and try and drive one for a vintage review. So here's the pitch. If you happen to be one of the, you know, hundreds of thousands of people consuming this podcast in any format, and you are an LFA owner, we would love it very much if you reached out tips@carid.com. Or just leave us a comment right here. We'd love to come drive the car, take some pictures of it, do a video, and make your car famous. Anyways, probably not.
I can't wait for the Venn diagram of Car ID Project Scars listeners and LFA owners to
overlap fully.
Just know it. Okay, sure, that too. No, just like that first little crescent when they first converge. I'm gonna throw a party on that day. I'm really excited.
It's gonna be a great day. But Right on. How about you, Brett? We haven't even talked about, did you have anything interesting in cars you're driving this week or project updates for us?
I am just in perpetual limbo with projects. So this is my motorcycle that I just got back from the shop, and it got a bunch of, I got like the carbs rejetted and tuned and synced up. And then I did electronic ignition to kind of finally do away with the points and generator system, which is great.
Hell yeah.
That thing was burning through points like probably every 500 mile. I bet every two tanks it was burning through points. Whoa. So there was something wrong with it for sure. But I just was like, I'm done with it, period. So
that sounds like a missing resistor or like a shot condenser or something.
It's a super Mickey Mouse old wiring harness, because the previous owners have just like added turn signals and removed turn signals and added, you know, just accessory, like just a bunch of stuff that no longer is on the bike. And so it just is a mess. But anyway, so I got it back and it rode amazingly for like 2 weeks, and now it's got a really severe misfire. So I'm going through the ignition and the fueling right now to just try and diagnose it a little bit more. And then I noticed it has a really leaky tank. So that's job one, is we're going to replace all the fuel lines coming from the tank. And hopefully that'll solve some of the issues. I wonder if maybe it's just been getting like fuel dumped on it or whatever. But so that's my project for maybe this weekend. If we can get the temperatures in my neighborhood to go below 90 degrees, I might try and tinker on it this weekend.
Oh my God. What's the goal? First of all, Brett, will you remind us, just for those of you not looking at the screen, like what the bike is?
And sorry. This is a 77 Kawasaki KZ650. This was like their volume seller in the 70s and 80s. Just kind of like a very boring four cylinder twin cam motorcycle. But I've had it for 14 or 15 years now. I had it all through college, and I moved on it. Like it was the only possession that I took when I moved from Idaho to Texas. And that was a crazy fun ride. And I like got to Texas and I had a backpack and got to kind of just like set up a life. And it was a very Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance kind of trip. But
that sounds like a blog to me, my man.
It was fun. I do remember. So I did it in October, which was right on the cusp of bad weather. So I got through Idaho okay. I got through Colorado okay. And then once I crossed into, once I crossed into Texas, I started getting hit by like this steady drizzle at like 40 degrees. And I remember like being soaked to the bone and like on the verge of tears. And my hands are like frozen to the handlebars and just like questioning every decision I had ever made in my life that led to this point. Like questioning whether putting playing cards in my bicycle as a 9-year-old to make the motorcycle sound led to this, like that deep level of like existential crisis.
It's real motorcycling though. Like you've never truly motorcycled until you are like actually praying for death. As you're like, I would be dead, but I'd be warmer.
And I actually do need to, my brother was living, I was moving to Dallas and my brother lived in Austin at the time. And he actually did meet me, like 300 miles away from Dallas. I can't remember the name of the city, but he met me in this little town in his 3 Series, and I had to be to work the next day. So I like couldn't stop. And so he was gracious enough to let me drive his 3 Series to Dallas, and he got a hotel in that little town for the night and then rode my bike the next day. So shout out to Christian for being an awesome older brother and saving me from myself. But awesome bike. It just, I can't bear to like, I thought about selling it so many times and I kind of just can't bear to, but it's been languishing. It's been sitting for a month now, and I need to just get my rear in gear and actually get it on the road a little bit more frequently.
Well, the good news for you is, although I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination on old motorcycles, it's probably not worth any money, right? So it's not like you're sitting on something like that could be turned into another large project or sort of like a cash infusion for one of the cars that you're working on. That would be hugely meaningful either, right?
The issue though is that like the longer, you know, as with anything mechanical, the longer it sits, the worse it gets. And so, you know, the last time I let it sit for like 2 years a while ago, and it needed $2,000 worth of work to get it roadworthy again. This most recent time, I had my cousin did a bunch of the work, and he was undercharged me like crazy. So it was only about $500 worth of work. But I just don't want to get it to that point again, where I again have to spend another $500 to $1,000 to ride it for 2 weeks and then let it sit. You know, like I just need to get it sorted and consistent.
Gotcha. Well, the good thing is that since you've already spent like $2,500 on this motorcycle, there's not that much more stuff physically in the motorcycle.
Sure. You know? I would love to think that that's true. I would love to believe that I've just cured everything and that it can't possibly get any worse.
I bet if you pull the tank, pull the seat, change all the fuel lines and just check the wiring for shorts and then probably replace the petcock or at least clean it really good.
Yeah.
You'll be golden. Like they're not tough.
That's the other thing is, you know, despite it being everything's tiny on it, you know, like mm-hmm. you're working in miniature at this point, but there's just not that much complexity to bikes didn't have emissions controls at this time. Syncing four carburetors is a pain, but theoretically that's already been done. And it's just going to hopefully be relatively simple if I can get my mind around it and get my club fingers around it.
Well, everybody's sleepy today. There's no real work being accomplished at the Old Car ID Drive blog. I say, Brett, you go grab a case of beer, head over to Kyle's house. Kyle, you get the shop organized and you guys will get this thing knocked out by quitting.
Honestly,
you can put your motorcycle next to my pile of motorcycle parts and they'll sort of feel good about each other. And I think things will happen.
I love it.
I have like, you know, 1.5 Honda CB350s. That like, you know, one is an expensive project and the other is leftovers from an expensive project.
Someday if we do, we've talked about this a little bit before, we sort of by dint of our editorial mandate, like focus on things that have four wheels. But everybody, I don't ride motorcycles, but I love motorcycles. Everybody, you guys own them. Everybody cares about them. Maybe we'll get our old buddy, Jason Marker, former editor-in-chief of Ride Apart, onto the show, and he can share some pictures of his garage, which is literally wall-to-wall motorcycles.
Yeah, that guy has a sickness, and I love it.
He really does. He really does. And he's good at talking about it, too, if he's not. Another grumpy man, too, so he'd be great for having
I played D&D really with him for like the last year, so.
A grumpy game master, a grumpy mm-hmm. dungeon master, a grumpy webmaster, but an all-around good guy. Well, cool. Why don't we move into our other topic today? Brett, you want to introduce this one? This is your idea, and I think it's a really fun thought exercise.
Yeah, I've actually decided to call it Brett's Magic Wand. and I'm really excited for you guys to play with Brett's Magic. This is a game where if you had a magic wand of reliability and could wave it over any car, what car would you choose and why? And so the idea of this is, you're not making some unobtainable, like, I'm never going to own a Talbot Lago, so I'm not going to use my magic wand of reliability on a Talbot Lago because I'm never going to have $2 million. This is kind of like an attainable, reasonably priced vehicle that just you will never, ever own. And the other thing is, you're not turning it into a bulletproof, completely unbreakable machine. You're kind of like bringing it to the level of a 2000 Chevrolet Impala with a 3.4. Parts are always going to be available. It's still going to occasionally break, but you can generally fix everything you need to fix without a bunch of specialized and expensive tools and parts. So, like, this is kind of just like a baseline, reliable project car exercise. Seth, I think you have some great ones lined up, and I want to talk about them.
Yeah, I maybe went a little newer with this, and also I was adding stuff before you guys did, so I don't want to spoil anything, and maybe you surprised me, but my default answer to this would be, because it's a car that I tried to buy a couple of times, would be some version of a Jaguar XJ, right? I don't want to step on that if one of you guys are picking it, but I went in a slightly different direction, a slightly newer direction, because I do think recently when I was selling the Mercedes and ended up buying the WRX, sorry, I can't talk and share at the same time. I was looking at other cars that were a little bit newer that, you know, we all sort of love this, the sweet spot of the depreciation curve, right? Like cars that were really good when they were new, they were probably too expensive or something that you wouldn't consider primarily because of price when they were brand new. But you see them just tanking in value as they get older. And a lot of models do that, like, because they don't have a great reputation for reliability, or they actually are unreliable. They have bad problems, right? And Italian cars fall into this. Honestly, Swedish cars fall into this. Volvos, I think, are really great in this regard, too, because maybe a little less on the down the fun scale and a little bit more reliable than something like what we're looking at now, which is an Alfa Romeo Giulia Quadrifoglio. I actually think this is from the Alfa Romeo's media site, and I believe this car was first offered in the US in 2017 or 18. I can't remember now, but this is like one of the earlier versions of the car. It hasn't really changed. They've done a facelift to it, but it hasn't, like, they haven't done anything like mega with the car since it's been new. I last drove one of these extensively 2 years ago in Italy. I was there with Alfa doing Mille Miglia as like a support team, support vehicle. So we drove the, I'm forgetting the name of it, the 100-year anniversary version of the Alfa Quadrifoglio. So I have a ton of time in this car. They're awesome. Like, I mean, this is like such a rad car to drive. It's a really raw is the wrong word because it's still filtered, but it's a sports sedan that has way higher levels of feel and feedback than you're getting from like a brand new, you know, fresh to the market sports car today. You know, just like an old school exhaust snarl, super quick, not very well mannered. I mean, you can get yourself in trouble with the car if you're, you know, like getting too aggressive in corners or lack traction in like a wet situation or something like that. Just kind of everything I love about the car. And then I also just think it looks ungodly gorgeous. I think it's a fantastically designed, beautiful car that's really hard to pick nits with, even in the interior. And I think the Stellantis stuff in the interior tends to be cool looking and then maybe fall apart a little bit. But I actually think the overall quality of materials in a Quadrifoglio is pretty high. So these are not very expensive right now is what I was finding. I don't want to like be quoted on the price because I would need to look at averages. But I think that I was seeing, you know, early Quadrifoglios in the like high $20,000 range at this point, which is wild, like considering the amount of vehicle that you're getting for the sort of power and performance envelope that you're getting with a car like this. Mm-hmm. But you guys probably remember this too. I have not done the deep dive on what problems exist today, right? Like the thing that the buyer's guide sort of recommendation, like what you would want to look out for in a car like this. But man, did these early cars like just come in for a ton of problems when it was first launching, both as reported by the media and also sort of bubbling up in forums on Reddit pages and things like that. Alfa historically has had a really bad reputation in the US. I think in my mind, it's fair to draw a bright line between kind of Alfas from the 70s and 80s and Alfa from today. I don't think we're talking about the same level of reliability issues at all. I think these are much, much, much more reliable cars, but you're still having, seeing like sometimes big, scary things happening. The cars, the cooling system's not working as they're supposed to. I think there are issues with differential, et cetera, right? So
it's, was it Car and Driver who had their Quadrifoglio just blow up on them?
Yeah. They had, like a catastrophic failure, I think, in theirs. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, every like, most press cars I've seen come and go, like with, you know, other friends in the media, like they've had, like I had a light come on the second day I had it and it solved itself right away and was fine. But, you know, I've heard of people like having their cars go into limp mode and this is all hearsay. Like, that's the thing is like, we're not consumer reports. We don't like, we don't do reliability studies, but you know, like, yeah, I've heard of a lot more issues with these cars than with, you know, with a lot of their competitors. So
yeah, and if nothing else, so using Brett's magic wand of reliability, right? The thing that I would be concerned with is not necessarily that I would buy this car and it would you know, take a dump on me immediately. It's more that depreciation curve, we're not actually at the bottom of it, that I just wouldn't be able to get a reasonable amount of my money out of it. Or you have such a difficult sales process afterwards because, let's be honest, like people still talk about this, talk about like whatever Alfa experience they had 30, 40 years ago at this point without understanding that things have changed a little bit too. So, again, I don't know if that one fully counts, but it's one that I definitely, it's a car that I love. Another one, I'm staying Italian here and I'll just click through is, well, there are really two versions. This is the C. This is the one that I really want. Fiat 500C Abarth, I believe is how they stack those words. So this is the convertible version of the 500 Abarth, which is just like an awesome pocket rocket of a car, incredibly flawed, right? Like I did the launch event for this car when it first came out. I've driven every version of it a million different times. All of them are problematic, right? Like dynamically, they don't have, you know, they're not actually really that fast, but they sound like they've got 900 horsepower running through them, just a cracking exhaust, really overdriven front wheels in many cases, like not enough grip, but all things that I just find hilarious and super entertaining. And there's something about the C version, which is, I've had this argument with people a million times. Like it's not truly a convertible either. It's essentially like a large fabric sunroof. So on one hand, it's kind of a crappy convertible, but on the other hand, you're not forced into some of the other compromises that you would have with a full convertible version of, you know, like a super powerful, tiny front wheel drive hatchback, that has lost even more structural rigidity in theory, or added a ton more weight. Right. So, and again, like I know that the Abarth versions are keep more of their value a little bit, but 500 C's, maybe it's because I'm in Southeast Michigan and so many of these got sold to people who had, you know, like worked for Stellantis or a Stellantis brand. 500 you could pick up for no money. Like, you know, under $5,000 in a lot of cases for cars with not very much miles on them at all. Sometimes well under that if you're willing to get into something with like 90 to 100,000 miles. The Abarth, I'm not, again, like it's not like I priced it out before this, but I think that you're, you know, you're talking about $10,000-$12,000, like probably about what I paid for my WRX, which is 13 years old at this point in a much newer car. So
the decision that they made to not put a muffler on these cars is so on paper so stupid and so like the most just Italian thing possible, but it is the best part about the entire car. Everything else is, it's like, it's flawed. It's fine. Whatever. It's not technically good, but it's kind of a good time.
Mm-hmm.
But the sound it makes with all the turbo whistle and like the burbles, and it's like the angriest, little purse dog ever. Like, the lady like taking her, her chihuahua to Whole Foods and it's just biting everybody as you go past, you know?
I remember I drove this car when I was 21 or 22. I conned a dealer into letting me take it for a test drive. And I had my mom with me, which is probably why they did it. And she like folded herself in the back seat while the dealer rode up front. And as a like 22-year-old, this was just like, this was as good as it got. Like it was absolutely going to be my car when I graduated college. And I love these so, so much. Yeah, I think you should do it. And I don't even think you need the magic wand of reliability. I know like a lot of them rust, but if you get a California car or a West Coast car and just keep it in the garage during the winter, I think you might be okay.
Yeah, and that's fair. And again, like I'm going entirely on word of mouth here and no like firsthand knowledge of things breaking down. I know that, again, the reason that they're so affordable right now is because, you know, one, it's a weird little Fiat. There's not a huge market for a super small two-door hatchback to begin with, but also it, just the name alone kind of drags the residuals down on the car, is great for people who can enjoy like what this weird package has to offer. So,
I mean, I remember when they hit their depreciation curve really hard, like in 2016, 2017, you could get a 2012 Abarth for under 10 pretty easily. And I was seriously considering it. And, I worked at Truck Trend at the time, and one of our sister titles was European Car Magazine. And Mike Febbo, the editor of European Car, had one as a long-termer. And he said that he got it on a lift to change out the shocks and strut to do, I think he was doing either a coilover kit or like a Bilstein B5, you know, like a upgraded suspension kit. And every bolt underneath the car, living in Southern California, every bolt underneath the car was frozen, like locked, rusted shut on a 2-year-old car. And so that kind of like turned me off really quick. So I know there's like things that go wrong on these that make them a gigantic pain in the butt to own, but
yeah,
might be worth it.
Yeah. There's certainly some out there that were like well-loved and that people didn't drive a whole lot that are probably in reasonable condition and none of them go for any money. So they are super fun. It would also be just a great, like Kyle, your point is good in a lot of ways. Like this is, it's kind of like a car that's a tuner car already. That's just been really well done. Like a tuner car from the factory. Right. Mm-hmm. So like on that front, it's one that I would personally feel a lot less precious about like doing some silly things with, right? In terms of just like wringing its neck to get all the performance out of it, or turning it into a autocross car, or you know, something that you bring to the track every once in a while and just be hilarious. I think that can be really cool. And I'm sure that there are examples out there. If anybody out there has or knows of a cool example of any kind of 500 or Abarth that's been tuned and somebody's done a really nice build on it, share it with us, and we'd love to either throw it on the screen or tell readers or listeners about it later.
I think you just need to find a way to put like two-step, like anti-lag on it, because it's already got like no muffler. And then just like every stoplight, just bang, 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 bang. And then like you like take off and you're doing 60 like a minute later. But, you know, that would be great.
Especially if you live in L.A., that's the way to go. So that when you need to go to Vons, you've got the best grocery getter out there.
That's exactly right.
Speaking of grocery getters, Kyle, you want to tell us about your first choice? Let me put it up on the screen.
Sure.
This comes from a folder called Kyle's Treasure Trove of Unreliable Euro Trash.
Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, first I'm going to say I will own one of these in probably the next couple of years. I have a sickness, and it's that I love Land Rover and Range Rover products a lot. They're so cool. They're so comfortable. They do all the cool off-road stuff. But as we all know, and as pretty much everybody knows at this point, they're cataclysmically unreliable. I've never had a Land Rover press car that hasn't had something pre-broken or broken during my drive, during my week with it. And I don't care. Like, I would wave the wand and I would drive this thing into the ground. I love them. They're so cool. And the L322.
You don't need the magic wand of reliability to own. You're just going to own one anyway.
Yeah, I'm an idiot, but like other people, you know. But yeah, like, and in all fairness, like, I love the L322 body style kind of the most, but they're actually supposed to be the most reliable of the Range Rover family, particularly like the, I think it's the 07 to 09 cars, which had the earlier Jaguar, engines in them. And those are actually supposedly really stout. And then once you get into like the 5 liter motors and the supercharged one, then they get real bad again because timing chain issues and stuff. But
because before the it was a 4.2, right? The early Jag,
the supercharged, the first Jag motors with the superchargers 4.2 that puts out about 400 horsepower, and then there's the 4.4 liter, and that's naturally aspirated, which is like the one that I would want, and that puts out like three something.
Jag motor? I thought those were BMW motors.
No, so they were BMW motors first, and there was a 4.4, the M62 B44 or something. And then in 06, they transferred over, or changed, 06 or 07, they changed over to the Jag motor. Yeah. I haven't, like, done any research on these or anything, you know. I love them. Like, they're so cool. The interiors are so nice. And like for the most part, they've held up pretty well, just in terms of like leather and things like that. Like, it's all stuff that like the British brands do really well. So like leather and wood and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm a sucker for that sort of thing. But yeah,
could you go Discovery?
Oh, yeah. I love discos. Yeah, okay. For sure. I mean, Disco 2, I don't even know if Brett's magic wand could fix that. There's one person I've ever
Brett's
met.
Magic wand is a very talented thing, so don't you worry.
So I hear.
I think it could fix it.
Yeah, there's only one person on Earth that I've come across that's had good luck with a Discovery 2, and that's the wonderful Andrew Quillen from Honda Acura PR.
Oh,
he has had like the most trouble-free Disco 2 experience ever, and I'm like, why is your life an unbroken string of green lights, buddy? You got a cute dog. You own a house. You have a nice wife. You just had a baby and a trouble-free Disco too. Save some for the rest of us, pal. You know, that's all I'm saying.
Well, I'm just so bitterly disappointed that Andrew Quillen of Honda Acura PR doesn't own a Honda Crossroad instead of a Land Rover Discovery.
It's true. He should rebadge it at least.
He really should. So the Crossroad was one of these weird, like, bastard stepchildren of, like, the Honda Rover tie-in, where, like, we got the Sterling 827, which was an Acura Legend, and the Rover 400, which was a Honda Civic. And then the Honda Crossroad was a weird-ass two-door Land Rover Discovery with Honda.
It was a Disco 1, I think, yeah. But yeah,
so I really think great. I think he needs to down badge that right away.
100%. And then like an LR3, I would also 100% do.
Yeah.
Those things are crazy though. So they have like a unibody body and they sit on a fully boxed ladder frame. So that's why they weigh like 6,500 pounds. And perfect. You know, they're like, their V8 is their wheezy, like 350 horsepower V8's just like struggling to keep them going, but they're
You could even get the Ford 4-liter Cologne V6 in those, which had like 230 horsepower at that time.
You could, and I think it was actually less reliable than the Jag V8, which is amazing to me. But yeah. So yeah, Land Rover would magic wand it in a heartbeat.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I use the Mercedes R129 for an example, but the truth is anything with a V12. Like, I want to own a V12 vehicle so bad, and like not even like for high performance, like screaming Ferrari purposes, but like I want it to be like the gasoline powered equivalent of an electric car. I want it to be like so smooth and quiet, and just like I want to look at it and know that it's like super expensive and stupid.
Have you driven one of these, Kyle?
I have. They're lovely.
So great, right?
Yeah. I mean, people talk about like the V8, which has like more power or like the same amount of power and it's less complicated and blah, blah, blah. I want the complication. Give me more cylinders, please. But again, like if anything breaks, like a coil pack for one of these is like $3,000 and there's two of them. Like stuff like that. It's crazy. And that stuff does go wrong. BMW V12s from the similar era, same thing. BMW's like, well, we've got all these straight sixes. Let's just make V12s and have two of everything. So the BMW V12s have two computers, two distributors, two like everything. And they're BMWs, so that's obviously not great for anybody. So I would definitely magic wand some V12 into my life, 100%.
I support this.
So I've never been in any of the sort of golden era Mercedes or BMW 12-cylinder engine cars.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely was on the side of don't spend the extra $80,000 on modern versions of SLs and S-Class and 7 Series or whatever. You know, it was like sometimes close to or in excess of $100,000 to get the V12 variant of you know, a 760 as opposed to a 750. Just as a new vehicle, it didn't make sense because they were a little more charming in my mind, but like worse performers. And I just didn't really see the rationale other than having the badge and being able to sort of floss in your driveway a little bit more.
Right. Yeah, these like, cars all live in a post-logic sort of timeline.
Oh, yeah.
And so like you get them because they're expensive, complicated, and stupid, and like because you can, and not because they're better. And
I remember having like a bench race with this kid in my middle school class who his dad had an SL55, I think.
Mm-hmm. Good car.
SL55 AMG. It was a supercharged. So, I mean, like 493 horsepower. It was crazy. And I had just read an article about the SL600. And I can't remember if I was trying to pick a fight, but I think I said something like, bummer, it's not the V12. And he like got so ticked off because the SL600 has less power. It's not as fast. It's more expensive. Blah, 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 blah. I don't care, though. Like the starter noise alone of a Mercedes or a BMW V12 would be worth the cost of entry. Just that, like it sounds like it literally sounds like you're firing up a jet engine. It's just, good choice. Yeah.
You're great.
You're rehired. Good job.
I'm scrambling to find the generation. I'm so bad with the BMW internal model designations, but the two 7 Series generations ago, right?
Was that
So it was.
That's E65, the Bengal one, or the one before it? Because that's
E38. No, the Bengal one. Maybe it's only one. It was the post Bengal car. This would have been like in the 10-ish range.
It was like the M760, right?
Yeah.
Right.
That car, and again, like, not just because we're talking about the magic wand reliability, and not because I have any knowledge about what was happening with the car, but I, over the course of maybe 18 months, I had a loan on the calendar for the publication that I was at for a 760, right? And the only thing that we knew about it, we saw the Monroney, was that it was whatever their shade of gold was then. And we were very excited about the car. The car got canceled. Like, I was working at a place called Winding Road. It got canceled two or three times at Winding Road. And then I had the very same car back on my car schedule at Autoblog when I moved over there. And it was also canceled there before I finally got it. So we started calling it the Golden Ghost because we just assumed that it wasn't a real car and that it wasn't going to show up. But it does speak to the theme. And when I finally got it, it was wonderful. I remember taking it. To this day, like, remember very specific details of that drive that I went on around my house because I had such a good time in it and because there was such a buildup for it. But they couldn't even in a like very well managed media fleet in and around Detroit with lots of techs looking at it and BMW like paying attention to it. Like, they couldn't, for whatever reason, that car, they just could not keep on the road, or they kept giving it to Car and Driver and they were doing crazy stuff with it and they took it off my loan. I can't really say for sure, but the V12s open you up to a host of issues, certainly, that the V8s sure. do not. So
we don't care.
I love them. Yeah, they're great. And then my sort of final pick is once again the BMW, and I drove this exact car. So this is from the BMW Historic Collection. It's Lime Rock Park. They've owned it since new. It's a DCT car, and I was on the BMW program a couple of years ago for Car Week, and one of the cool things about the BMW programs for that is they're usually just like, yeah, we brought some historic stuff out, come drive it, and we don't really have that much else to do for you or for you to do except for like a dinner. And you're like, great, so I'll just go have fun. And so I got to drive this thing. This was like when I was still thinking about getting my 911, and I've wanted a 911 since forever, and this car almost changed my mind. It's just so good. Like, way better than like it should be, given like the sum of its parts. The engine is magical. Again, low torque, down low, but it sounds great, and it just screams. The transmission really suits it, but man, rod bearings, wow. BMW can't seem to figure those guys out. Like, everybody else, no problem, but BMW, nope, they're wear items, better replace them every, you know, whatever.
Well, and isn't that engine, so rod bearings have been like a known factor since like 1995, right? Like the S52 had rod bearing issues. S54, they've all had them, right?
Yeah.
Isn't the S65, it's having more issues than that now. As like the cars get closer to 100,000 miles, they're like actually having like full-blown engine failures.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, for a company with motor in their name, you'd think they'd swing a little harder. But as it turns out, not so much. But yeah, again, this car is like just wonderful. I hate orange cars, and I would fully put aside that hate for the Lime Rock Park, because it's got like a performance exhaust and like all the little upgrades that you could get throughout the years on these cars, and it's like the send off. And so I'd just take Brett's magic wand and I'd just beat the hell out of this car with it until it was reliable.
As a tangent on this, I love the cars. This is the opposite of the thing that we started talking about with BMW and the Lexus. Mm. I love it when a manufacturer brings together like some disparate packages or elements to a car to make it really special without doing something that's brand new, like re-engineering, putting a new motor in it or doing something that's more dramatic, right? And I think this is the Lime Rock Park version. You know, it's got the competition package on it, but it's got other elements too that they weren't all offered in any other way, which makes it really special. Of course, it's got badges and a special color too.
Right.
But this one is really, really good. Maybe my favorite version of my favorite M3
It's also my favorite M3, like by a country mile.
Yeah, so good. You have to work so, I mean, the car is incredibly quick, or can be, but you just have to work super hard for it.
Yeah, it's like an old turbo car where you're like keeping it on boil all the time. Like you're just making sure that you don't dip below like $4,000, or, you know, you're going to be waiting a while kind of thing.
It doesn't hurt either that like the way that they designed this car, like it threaded that needle between like Bengal flame surfacing and early BMW like purity and cleanliness so well. Like it doesn't look nearly as like staid or sedate as like earlier e-chassis cars, but it also doesn't have any of the like extra like frippery of later BMWs or of other Bengal era BMWs. This is just like the perfect car design in so many ways. Right.
And all like the sort of like extras that it has, like the power bulge in the hood or like the big fenders and stuff, it's got for a reason. Like you get big tires, and it's got a friggin' V8 in it with a huge plenum. And like, so that stuff all makes, you know, it all makes sense. And kind of to what Seth was saying, like, yeah, this is very much sort of like a greatest hits kind of love letter to this chassis, in the same way that like Porsche with the GTS, it's like, they just put all your favorite stuff on it and give it to you for, you know, like you just don't have to think about it. It's clearly like people in product planning enjoying their job a little bit too much and just like, you know, here, let's share this with you. But yeah, this car is reliability. It's deeply flawed in the reliability department, as are all BMWs, bless their little hearts. But yeah, this one I would just wail on it with Brett's magic wand.
Yeah, good picks. All good picks, for sure. How about you, Brett? What do you got?
You're muted, buddy.
Other than a mute button.
We're staying in the same general geographic area. Let me pull up my first one.
I love that all of these basically have been European cars thus far. Like...
A little bit.
It's the birthplace of the automobile, and yet here we are.
So Kyle touched on it a little bit, and I still have faith that a magic wand of reliability could turn a Discovery 2 into a reasonable vehicle. I don't have much to say about these. I don't honestly know that much about these, to be totally frank, except my aunt owned one for a little while, and anytime she parked it for longer than 15 minutes, the rear axle would completely bottom out 100%. Because it just had the leakiest, least usable air suspension in the world. But I just like, I love the way they look. I love the interior quality. I love the gigantic windows and the tiny little pillars and the safari windows over the rear, the third row seats. This is just like the ultimate. People talk about the Defender, and the Defender is great. This is like the Land Rover for me. This is like the archetype of Tony Posh, but still a little bit attainable off-roading for me. And I love them. I love everything about them. I think they look great. I just would love to have one that worked. So, and I know that actually the 3500 Rover V8 that some of these came with is not a terrible engine. And it's reasonably easy to find parts for because they sold it all over the place in British cars. But then it also came to America, in the 60s in a Buick. It was like one of the first all aluminum engines in an American car, and it came in a Buick. And so I know that they're not terrible to keep on the road. I think it's just everything else. I have this fun, let me find it. Great car. I love it. But this cutaway that just like seems to presage how hopelessly complicated these things must be under the skin.
Yeah. Like, you know, things are bad when they start coming up with nicknames for warning light combinations, like the track control hill descent ABS light, or known as the Three Amigos, like in the community. I also love these because they share so much mechanically and from like a body standpoint with the Range Rover, the original Range Rover Classic.
Yeah.
It's like when like if you get into one and then get into the other, you're like, oh, that makes so much sense. But yeah, these things are great. And with the engine problems, I think a lot of it started to really manifest with the Disco 2 because they kept punching that Rover V8 out bigger and bigger and bigger. And also by the end of the production, like 03, 04, the tooling on that stuff was so like sloppy and worn out. And that's why you get dropped cylinder liners, which is like one of the biggest problems, specifically with the 03 models. And like that's why they retired that motor after, pretty much, is like they could not keep making it physically.
I just like wonder, I want to, Frankenstein in me wants to like backdate a like 19, what was it? 19, frick. Buick had a, I think they had a turbocharged version of this engine in the 60s. And I just want to backdate that nonsense into this and just like have it be ridiculous and have it be the power that you needed to have. But it's also a very early model and very simple and very easy to keep running. I don't know. Like that's the, that's kind of like the,
That's a beautiful idea. I just want to make sure that you're keeping firm hold on the magic wand of reliability before you undertake that.
That's the point though. I could do that and just be like, hey, dink, here you go. Turbocharged Buick V8. Here's your magic wand of reliability. Now you run like a Chevy 3400. Anyway. So that's my first car. I love them. I think they look cool. Honestly, like that's the primary motivation here.
Alpine windows forever.
My next one's a little more rooted in actual like fact. And so this is the Audi RS6. I've actually driven this exact vehicle, this white one. And I went with Audi to Canada and we drove every iteration of the RS6 Avant. And it was an amazing trip. Brilliant in so many ways. This was like the high point. This has the Lamborghini Gallardo's 5.2 liter V10 under the hood, and fitting that thing under the hood of a front wheel drive biased platform is just ridiculous. And there's no room in there. I don't actually think these are that unreliable per se. And as far as a Lamborghini can be reliable, I just think that the packaging is nightmarish. Like you have to pull the engine for everything. Like you have to like remove all kinds of accessories and covers and stuff like that to do spark plug changes, for heaven's sake. And even like bigger ticket maintenance items like timing chain guides and things like that. Like you literally have to take off the entire front clip of the car and pull the engine out forward because all the accessory drives are on the backside of the engine bay. So like everything that you might like, alternator belt, like things like that are literally up against the firewall. And so that just feels like it's crying for a magic wand of reliability, not so that it can be made more dependable, but just so that you can do things on it without having to pull the engine out the front and leave it sitting on an engine stand while you do your work. And
well, it also strikes me, this is maybe the best example of that we've talked about of the cars that we've talked about so far, but so many of these cars are probably were conceived as cars that people wouldn't work on by themselves, right? You wouldn't work on at home, that you would bring them in. And I think that you could still make that argument, right? Like you could buy an RS6 and you could say, well, I'm just going to take it to the dealer. That's all, or dealer or somebody who is like qualified to do the job for you. The problem is you're still going to have to do that maybe more frequently than you would expect with another car. And it's an insane amount of money to have them work for you. Right. So you're not out of the woods. I think you can always say a large, you know, like an MX is a good stand in for the wand of reliability if you're willing to flash it, but you're spending more money here as well. So,
yeah, no, it's literally just kind of about like the whole idea of the game is just like taking something that would destroy you emotionally and completely bankrupt you and turn it into something that like you could just enjoy without having to. I feel like so many performance cars, every time you wind it out to red line, you're like, all right, well, I'm one red line closer to that $10,000 engine out service. You know, like you just kind of have that in the back of your head all the time. And it would just be nice not to have to your credit, if I had $1 billion and I could just go buy one of these and just take it to the, like have it trailered or concierge delivered to the Audi shop in my area. Totally. Absolutely. But
Why not?
So this is probably like my dream. And then this is kind of the more down to earth version of that same vehicle. Volkswagen Passat W8. These come up in my area all the time for like $8,000. Some of them even have the 6-speed manual transmission. Just seems like such a weird, not a great car in a lot of ways, but just a weird, interesting vehicle that again is completely ruined by the fact that every single maintenance item that you have to do involves 18,000 other maintenance items to get to the thing you need to work on. And if you're doing it at a shop or at a dealer, you're guaranteed spending $500 every time they need to pop the hood on that thing. And it just, I can't do it. I'd never be able to do it unless I had my special magic wand.
So the thing about the W8, I had a really good friend back when I lived in Washington whose parents were moneyed, and they bought one of these brand new, and it was never good. Like, no. In terms, like, it broke all the time, and every time it broke, it was a gajillion dollars. And so, like, they eventually gave it to him to drive, like, in college. And it's like, dude, do your parents hate you? What did you do to them? Like, why would that happen? Like, that's so horrible. But they are super cool. I love that that era of Volkswagen styling too is the best. Like, that's when they still looked like Volkswagens and not like everything else, you know?
Well, and to your, like, when you started to say they were never good, I think that's also true in terms of like dynamic. This was a $40,000 Volkswagen Passat. In a time when you could get a BMW 328 or a BMW 330 for the same price, this car had like 62% of its weight, not just on the front axle, but like forward in front of the axle.
Right.
Like, most of the engine is forward of that wheel center line. And just like not a great vehicle to drive in any respect, unless you're just kind of like cruising and having a good time. But I just, they're weird and they're cool. And like, kind of to that, like that V12 argument that we were having a minute ago, there are so many better options, not just concerning reliability, but just like from a driving standpoint. But you still just want the things you want, right? You still just want the weird thing that makes you feel a little funky and special. I just could never, I would never be able to own one. I'd never, like, I hate doing my own maintenance in general. And when I have to like thread my fingers in between two individual V banks to get spark plugs out of like tiny little valley that's about 3 inches wide, I could never do it. It would drive me crazy.
Yeah. I think the Phaeton, Volkswagen Phaeton W12 very much falls into this category where like the 8-cylinder is probably so much better to own in so many different ways, but who gives a crap? It's like the, it's a W12 Volkswagen with like, you know, it's like the madness of King George for, it's like the Ferdinand Piëch, equivalent of like the King George the Eighth or whatever it was.
Right. Yeah.
Was the W12 three banks of four or was it two VR6s?
It's like two VR6s.
Okay.
It's the same basic architecture that just ended as of like this month. They built the last one at the Bentley factory. Happy birthday, Seth, with balloons.
That was great. For those of you watching at home, I don't know how I just triggered those balloons that went up.
Did I do it?
Party time.
It's not my birthday. Nobody said the secret word, as far as I know. So
the word of the day is Phaeton.
So I think these are all good picks. Can I just, as we're having this conversation, it occurred to me that I once, and I'm sure we all have had a driveway that a real life driveway that required the magic wand that unfortunately doesn't actually exist. Can I share one photo where,
please, one of those now.
I was in dire need. This is on my Instagram. So apologies for the comments, but this was my real life. I lived this. I had a 986 Boxster that was not particularly well looked after before I got it. And then I really sorted it out by way of not a magic wand, but the local Porsche shop. which was fantastic. Still would do it again in a heartbeat, no question. Money is just money, but time in a Boxster on a wide open Michigan road in the summertime is something that's truly special. And then that's my mom's Fiero that somehow I still don't really know what happened. She gave it to me and I didn't want it. but I eventually just said yes when she kept telling me that I should have it over and over again. And also got to say a huge shout out to my guy, Larry, down at Illy's Motors in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who just like worked on this thing like it was his own little baby, and fabbed a bunch of stuff that needed to be fabbed that you couldn't buy on an 84 Fiero. We obviously put some new wheels on it. The wheels were shot. The tires were shot. And buying rubber for the original size wheels was impossible. It was going to cost like $2,000 to buy tires that actually fit the original size wheels. So we went that other way. But this is a really fun summer when I had both of these things. It was a short period of time. I loved it, but my bank account was dry.
Was that the Iron Duke? Is that the four cylinder?
Yeah. I always get it wrong. 2M4, 4M2. The manual transmission Iron Duke four cylinder version of the very first car that they made. Four speed manual truck engine. Not fast, cool car, but Actually, I still, to this day, I stand the Fiero a little bit. I think the original one was, I know that everybody likes the later ones, the later V6 cars, the GTs and stuff like that, but I thought the four-cylinder was really cool, and I am horribly blind to its flaws because I literally grew up in this car. My mom had it from new, so I was a baby riding around in it, and I really liked it. But
these are kind of cool because I remember the base model, you could get like a mileage maker transmission or overdrive or something like that.
Yeah, it literally did.
I think it was like 45 or 50 miles per gallon in EPA testing, which back then meant like 30 in real world driving. But 30 miles per gallon is not a terrible result for a 1980s anything.
No, certainly not from GM and in a weird sort of quasi experimental body. No, man, this car was cool. It also had Kyle. You wrote this story a couple of weeks ago or months ago already, like one of the earlier stories on Car ID Drive about the Infinity headrest speaker thing.
Yeah.
The sort of Corona speaker that goes around the headrest. Anytime I see anything like that where you've got the audio in the headrest, I'm immediately reminded of the Fiero because that was, I don't know if it was the first. It very well could have been cars way earlier, but this was the OG for me because it had the still upholstered, you know, like fabric headrest, but they had perforated speaker grills of a sort in them. And I just thought that they were the coolest thing I'd ever seen when I was.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely rad. This photo looks like something you would show your therapist. Like, oh, no. I see why you're here. Yeah, no, thank you for coming. This is good. We can work on this.
You stroll in, you're well-adjusted, you're well-dressed, you're attractive. You've got it all going for you. And you show your therapist this photo and you're like, and she's like, you're going to pay for my vacation house.
Yeah. You're putting a new wing on the old.
I have a great relationship with my mom. Everything's going great, but I own two mid-engine cars from the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. And also one of them has just leaked a huge puddle of fluid. No, it was really just water. But like when I first put that photo up, I thought it was like a subtle touch of comedy. So again, for those of you who are maybe listening and not watching right now, what we're looking at is I think a 98 Boxster, silver Boxster, and then my 1984 red Pontiac Fiero that is like driven backwards to achieve this photo and just left a huge trail of what turned out to be water that was stuck in a body panel somewhere after I had washed it like really thoroughly for the first time.
That's good. I think they don't rust too much.
Well, a lot of stuff does rust on them, just not the body panels.
So it still looks good as it returns to the earth. That's nice. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Joan Rivers.
I legitimately thought that was like some kind of tar snake. It didn't even like occur to me that might have come from the car.
It's because it's so huge. That's right.
So that is such a massive leak that it does not look like it could possibly come from a vehicle that's still on the road today.
When someone asks, can you lay a patch in that thing? You're like, hold on, brother. Check this out.
Although there's another one, if we're going to continue on our theme of doing tips about photos for selling your cars or how to list your cars, try and make sure that if it leaks something, at the very least, although you should disclose it, don't put a picture of it.
Unless it's a British motorcycle, in which case you're only showing that the motorcycle has oil in it.
It's designed to leak. It's
if it doesn't leak oil, maybe there's no oil.
That's a British oil change that we're talking about right there. If you're constantly leaking old oil out, you're constantly putting new oil in. What's the complaint about?
Yeah, that's what's going on with the X5 right now. So it's great. Yeah, I'm going to get a Christmas card from OPEC. but other than that.
Well, let's table X5 and talk more about what's going on there. Leaks, progress, hopefully some parts sometime in the near future on that one. We'd love to see. Thanks everybody for joining us for yet another fun rambly episode of Project Scars. You guys can catch us again. You can catch us whenever you want. We're here every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, 11 a.m. Wait, no. Yep, I did it right. 11 a.m. Pacific time.
10 a.m. Good job.
I need to take a nap. 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern time. You can check us out on Facebook, on YouTube, on Instagram, wherever you like to get your live video content. Subscribe to us if you prefer an audio podcast. Rate, review, all that good stuff. Thanks for watching. Thanks for joining us, guys. We'll see you later.
Vaya con Dios.